Hey, what's up, everybody? Eddie Gallagher here. As you guys know, one of my main priorities is taking care of my family and helping others take care of theirs. I spend a lot of time at the local range here teaching people how to control certain situations and get out of them safely. But the reality is there are certain situations, such as natural disasters, that we cannot control, which is why I've partnered up with My Patriot Supply. When these emergencies come, they usually come without warning, and the supplies that you need should be within reach, ready to go at a moment's notice. You can secure these supplies at preparewitheddie.com and start off with a 4-week emergency food kit from My Patriot Supply. If you act now, you can save $50 off of every 4-week emergency food kit. These emergency food kits provide up to 2,000 calories per day and can last up to 25 years. Once again, go on preparewitheddie.com and save up to $50 per kit. Thank you and God bless.
Welcome to Shoot Me Straight. Dave Fields, Eddie Gallagher. We're here today. I've been looking forward to this interview for a long time. My buddy, Joshua Broom, who, what an incredible background you have. And what an incredible ministry. Now, start off, just give us your background of where you grew up, what childhood was like.
So. So I grew up in a super small town in South Carolina. And my mom got pregnant with me at 15, had me at 16. And in this small town, my dad lived in this town. And I lived, I think, like a mile and a half away. And, this town is so small that, literally one grocery store, one gas station. And in that town, I didn't have a relationship with my dad, but I could see him. So I didn't have access to the person I saw, which was my father. So he was never, a dad in my home or in my life.
So he lived a mile and a half away from you?
Yeah.
You said?
Yeah. So super small town in South Carolina. And he lived just right down the way. And, so my mom, he was the same age as my mom. So, he gets married at 18, 19 and, they start having kids. So there's literally the home with the white picket fence, and he lives beside his mom and dad, and they have the life in which I thought only existed on a Hallmark channel, yet that was my dad living this life that I didn't have access to, which made me think, what the heck is wrong with me?
Yeah. So obviously your dad and your mom got pregnant, had you, and then he left and started his own family. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, I he never left. I think it was just really pretty much I don't know the nuances of their relationship, but pretty much there was a one night stand. My mom got pregnant. She chose to keep me, and he chose not to be involved in my life. And he played, he paid child support, or whatever, but he never played the role of a father in my life. So not that he left, he was never there.
Yeah,
but the strange thing about that, what's somewhat unique about my story, is that I could see the thing I didn't have.
Yeah, that's I mean, him being a mile and a half away. I mean, during that time, did he acknowledge you? Acknowledge that you were his son at all? Because I imagine you saw him in the small town.
Yeah, I would see him at the grocery store, see him out and about, and I think there were a few times where he had maybe I'd went to his house to spend some time with him, or he tried to come to where I was a few times. But I mean, this was a long time ago.
Yeah.
So, being the man that I am today, I have more empathy for him. And what I mean is this, the longer that shame occurs in our life, the more it grows. So the deeper shame he felt, the more disconnected he was from me, and the longer that lasted, it probably got more difficult for him to continue to reach out, while at the same time, being a husband and a father in his home, and that doesn't make it right, but it does make it true.
Yeah.
I think, it's very complicated situation, but I most certainly saw him, but we never connected.
Okay.
Yeah. So while you're in this hometown with your dad, you have this deep sense of I wasn't wanted, I was rejected.
Yeah.
We talked earlier, you see that led you into the path of trying to get accomplishments and playing sports and
I think just men in general, like you're wired to have a high achieving personality. It's like you're called to and created to do good, to operate with excellence, to commit to things, to show up, to work hard, to do all these things. The Bible uses the word like radah, like we're called to rule and reign over the earth. That's who we are to be. But you know, at the same time, when you see yourself through the lens of your brokenness, you believe, I can fix myself. You know,
yeah.
I can prove to the world that I'm worth something. And the world says, well, if you have enough, then you must be enough. So I thought, well, if I accomplish enough, even though the thing that I wanted to hear was, son, I'm proud of you.
Yep.
I thought, well, if I become, the best student or the best athlete or get the most girls or if I can get the most yeses, for every yes I can get, it can fill the void in which I don't have the dad in my life or the affirmation that I need from my father. I thought, well, if I can mitigate the gap through accomplishments and accolades and all the other stuff, I can feel as if I have what I need because mm-hmm. I can become the thing that I don't have.
Yeah, I think that's a common theme among a lot of men who sort of propel themselves forward into, what they think is greatness or what they, in their mind is like, this is what I have to achieve. And a lot of it is to prove themselves worthy to a lot of the times, and with men, it's their dad, right?
Yeah.
Even if their dad is at home, right?
Yeah.
So I think there's a relationship between the father and son where the son wants to prove like, hey, I'm worthy enough. And if the dad isn't consistent or even doesn't tell them like, hey, I love you, I'm proud of you, no matter what, that can force them to, right. And it's a good thing sometimes, because from the career field that I came from, when I served in the SEAL teams, a lot of guys that go towards that route come from trauma in their childhood, where that's what propels them that way.
Yeah, I mean, that's true in my life, in which, trauma propelled me to be excellent at what I do today.
Yeah.
But there had to be some healing and some redemption to happen.
For sure.
For me to be as effective as I could be.
Yeah.
And I think, to your point, there's different levels of fatherlessness and where, maybe you grew up like I did, or maybe there was divorce, or maybe there was death, or something I hear that's even more common is what you were saying. There's this absentee father, and I think that's why pornography is so destructive to men in today's culture, because 50% of divorces that happen in America are tied to pornography consumption in itself, or it led to a deeper level of infidelity. But what it also causes is you to believe, well, I need to protect you from the thing in which I'm ashamed of, or I need to protect you from the pain that I experienced or the trauma that I experienced. And when we parent through our brokenness, while we're trying to protect our kids, we actually hurt our kids. And we think, for me, it's like I grew up in, I've seen poverty, so I hate to say that I grew up in poverty, but I grew up having far less than those around me.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, if I had more money in the bank, it would somehow validate me in some way. And then when I had it and it didn't work, it was like, what the heck, And it's so easy for people to believe, well, if I give my kids the thing that they don't have, they'll feel the thing that I didn't feel. But love is actually the thing that they need most.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's a good word.
Could not agree more on that.
Yeah.
So you grew up in that town, small town.
Yeah.
Did a father figure ever step in, or were you just single mom the whole time?
Yeah, so my mom got married when I was like 7,
mm-hmm.
and it was it lasted for about 4 years. Heroin addict, he beat her. I think that was one of the most traumatizing things in my life, in which I had formed my identity as I am my mother's son. That is the thing in which I'm most proud of. I will protect her against anything and anyone. My mom even shares this story, when, she's in the grocery store and I'm, 5, I'm, throwing a can of corn at some, guy, trying to, catcall her or something. And, but when I'm, 8 years old, I remember, so clearly that there was a dresser pushed against their bedroom door, and I pushed it with my forearm just enough where I could see through the crack, and I saw him hitting her, and I couldn't get the door open. And the what was amplified was I already felt inadequate because my father had, what I felt like, rejected me. And now my only role in life is to protect my mom, and now I'm failing at doing that. Mm-hmm. So what good am I? So that was the only experience of any, like, man in a home. Coach B, my basketball coach, he was the only thing, you know, that was close to a male role model in my life. And he was someone that I think, you know, he planted seeds in me where he would see more in me than I saw in myself. And he would challenge me. He would call me out and call me up, which all men need. And I didn't really know how to respond to that, but I craved it in a weird way. We had a great relationship, but it was like very seasonal. So that was like the only example of anyone speaking into my life.
Yeah. So when did you end up leaving home?
So I go to college. So played basketball for a little bit, mm-hmm. studied theater, went to a little D2 school, joined a fraternity, and you know, just the level in chaos that I had access to was greater, and I, you know, cannonballed right into it. And you know, continue the behavior where it's like, you know, anything that I could accomplish or achieve to receive affirmation, I would, whether that be girls, sports, started modeling and acting, had some success in that, and you know, that was just kind of my new dopamine drug of choice. And along the way, I started like traveling and doing some modeling. And there were a few agents in LA that were like, "Hey, if you were in closer proximity to the industry in which you wanted to be in, we would love to represent you. But it's kind of tough, you know, for you to make it, like being where you are."
Yeah.
So I was like, "Hey, you know, I've got nothing to lose and everything to win." So I dropped out of college the second semester of my sophomore year and moved to Hollywood and started doing that.
What kind of, modeling were you doing at that time?
So I was doing mostly runway stuff.
Okay.
So a lot of runway shows and then some commercial stuff, but it was a lot of like Ed Hardy, like Von Frey.
Oh, man, yeah.
Stuff like that, you know.
That era. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Eddie awesome. Relates. He was, yeah. When were you a runway model, Eddie?
I still am, Dave. Yeah, on my off time. Okay, you get called out there. I mean, this story is already sound like I've heard plenty of other stories of where people get sucked into the darkness of Hollywood and LA.
Yeah.
So that's why I was asking, like, you know, what kind of modeling were you doing to where now they're in, like, come out here?
Yeah, LA. So I think with me, it was more so how I was living. So, I mean, long story, somewhat short. So I'm doing okay. You know, I'm represented by a relatively large modeling agency. You got to be good enough for them to allow you to train at the Improv. So I'm at the Improv in LA. I've got a decent agent, and I'm working. But at the same time, you know, if I'm living far beyond my means because I'm trying to live a life that equates to those around me. And I thought, like, that's what success looks like. So got to get another job to pay the bills on top of what I'm pursuing. So I'm working at this, like, restaurant/bar a few days a week. And it's in the middle of West Hollywood. And it's one of those places where, like, you don't, like, give a resume. You hand in a headshot to get hired, you know. And in this place, these three girls walk in, and they sit down, and they're headhunters for the porn industry. And they're like, "Hey, what do you think? Do you want to do porn?"
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, "Well, you know, I seen it for the first time when I was 13, and, you know, I've been very, like, sexually active since I was, like, 14. So the thing that they were inviting me into, like, outside of the camera and the check, it wasn't that much different than the way I was living. And I thought, you know, they intrigue me enough to have a meeting with their agent. And, you know, I think, like, good manipulators use manipulative language, because if you use language that breaks boundaries, more often than not, you can get someone to say yes to something they probably would have said no to. And I walk into, they say, hey, you want to meet this agent at this studio, and you have an appointment, and you'll meet with him, and you'll check in with the receptionist. So it sounds similar to, a traditional agent. So I go and I meet with this guy, and he's like, hey, I just want to ask you 3 questions. How did you grow up? What are you doing in LA, and what do you hope to accomplish? And for someone searching for, ammunition to manipulate someone, for me to say, hey, I grew up pretty much me and my mom, like, okay, you come from a broken home. You're searching for something you don't
That's
have.
That's a check mark right there. Yeah. We got them.
And then why aren't you in LA? It's like, well, I'm just like looking to be in this creative space, model and act or whatever. Like, okay, a lot of people are doing that. And then thirdly, I think is the most interesting, I said, I guess I want to be famous. And like being famous is vague. It's the same thing as being rich. It's like if there's no tangible metric attached to the thing that you're pursuing, you're actually pursuing nothingness. You're pursuing this idea of if I have something, I'll feel something. I thought, well, okay, if I become famous, then I'll feel like I'm somebody. But the problem with that is like how do you equate famous? How many movies do you need to do? How many people need to know your name? How many followers do you need to have on social media? How much money do you need to have in your bank for you to equate success or whatever with famous? And the problem with it is that even if you attach a metric to it, when you achieve it, it's not going to make you feel like you thought it would. And you're like, well, if I just have a little bit more.
Yeah.
So that's what I said. But what I was really saying when I said I wanted to be famous is, I want to feel seen. I want to feel known. I want to be loved. I feel like if I have that, I'll feel something that I don't feel today.
Yeah.
And he says, hey, I can make you famous. I can do this. You can do that. And I was like, all right, I'll do one. What would it cost me? What big of a deal would it be? And I do one. And, this is, 2006.
What was that like walking on the first
super set? Weird, man.
Yeah, I can't imagine, so you're brand new to it.
Yeah, so I mean, it was like, it was everything, it was nothing that I thought it would be. So I get to set, there's a receptionist. I'm going to fill out this paperwork, and the paperwork consisted of me filling out, traditional, W-9 or whatever, and then I filled out a release. And then a part of that release was, almost like your work permit being in that industry was a full panel STD and AIDS test. So that is the only time I knew who this person was. So it's like does her name and birthday on her test match her name and birthday on the copy of her IDs? And I had to sign that. So that was the only that was the closest to face on face real interaction I have with this person. So I signed that, and then I walk in, and there's girls in makeup chairs, and then there's catering, and then there's this sea of lights around this girl, and they're taking pictures of her. And then a PA comes up to me and is like, hey, we're going to need you in about 30, 45 minutes. I understand this is your first time. Here's a blue pill. Take it.
The Viagra?
Here's a Viagra. If you've never taken it before, I would suggest biting it in half, but totally up to you. It's in your hand. It's yours. Do with it whatever you want. And I go into the bathroom, and I'm having this fight, should I do this? I can't do this. I was like, man, I believed that my yes to that point had gotten me so far that I couldn't turn back.
Yeah.
And I think, that we end up 3 steps past where we ought have gone, and we believe that we can't make a U-turn. And for me, it's like, well, it was manipulative in that, okay, so the agent sent a town car to pick me up to bring me there. So what would I have to do to leave?
Yeah.
I would have to be a kid at a sleepover, dad, I'm scared. I need you to come pick me up. I changed my mind. So I would have to call him to say, hey, not only did I not follow through with doing the scene, I changed my mind. I just want to go home. And this is pre-Uber,
And how old are you at this time?
22.
22. Okay. So, yeah, you're still young. You're still,
Yeah. I mean, not only was I like young, literal in years, it's so adolescent in my development as a person because, you know, I was sharing with you, is like, dude, I live my life as like I'm a dude playing a dude disguised as another dude that doesn't know what dude he is. You know, it's like that because I had no clue who I am, and I would just put on this, you know, first date mask. I put on this like, I'm going to become whoever I think you want me to be, because if you knew who I was, like, I have no value. You're not going to want anything to do with
me.
Yeah,
I'm not worthy.
So the only way that I can, like, seem valuable to anyone is if I try to become who I think you want me to be. And that's so exhausting. But, yeah, so I do that. I do that film, and, you know, for 2006, it goes viral. And all of a sudden... you know, being, if you're familiar with a small town, it only takes one person to know one thing about your life for everyone to know everything about your life. So very quickly.
Oh, so that word got out in your town, like, pretty soon.
Yeah, very quickly my mom finds out, and I get this, like, really awkward call. You know, it's like, if you're from the South, like, you know, like, how much of your name someone uses is contingent of how much trouble you're in. So, like, when I hear Joshua Luke Broom, I'm like, I'm in deep. Doo-doo, you know, like, I'm in it, bro. And she's like, did you do a porno? I was like, dang, I was like, I did, Mom. And she was hurt, and I was humiliated. And then about a week later, I get another call, and it's my mainstream agent. She's like, hey, could you come into the office? I'm like, yeah, sure. Generally, when I would come in, if she asked me to come in, it was like we were evaluating a yes, right? There was a proposal. And it was going to require me to do X, Y, and Z, and this is how much I was going to be paid. And I went in. They're like, hey, unfortunately, we can't represent you anymore. Your name's tied to adult film content, and we can't be associated with your likeness anymore or represent you in any way. So I'm so sorry. We wish you the best. And then I start trying to call people, and I'm like, ah, it's not that big of a deal. No one's answering. No one's calling me back. No one's emailing me back. And all of a sudden, I was like, I really messed up. And then right on time, the porn agent calls. He's like, hey, I would love to offer you a year contract and represent you. I think you would just absolutely crush it. And I believed that there was nothing else I can do, which is absolutely not true. Like, was that my easiest yes? Sure. But it's an absolute lie that there was nothing else I could do. But I believed, you know, that's a dangerous thing about a lie. If you believe a lie to be true, it's true to you, and you live as if that lie is truth. And I naively thought, well, I can't continue to do what I want to do.
Yeah.
So I have to continue to do this because this is the only thing on the table. But what is true is I didn't have the understanding or the ability or the experience of what it meant to be resilient. I didn't know what it meant to be, what it would take for me to, pick myself up, dust myself off, make a different plan, and do the work needed to do something different, because that was hard.
Well, at that time, did you want, was there some of you, like after that first porno shoot, when you were done, did they affirm you, or did you give you, like, oh, you did a great job, and... like plant those seeds.
Oh yeah, they're like, oh, like you would crush it in this industry. It's like, you know, you would be like super successful. You would make a ton of money. You would be famous, so on and so on. But after I did it, I was like, I felt disgusting.
Yeah.
Because I mean, like literally, like you got camera A, camera B, camera C. There's someone shooting BTS. You know, there's, you know, you're using erectile dysfunction medication. The girl's using numbing cream. Like, you can't, like, half, like, feel anything. You're doing it for a camera. So you're not doing it to feel good. You're doing it to be seen, which is very different. And then, you know, on addition to that, like, you've got, like, more often than not, there's, like, some weirdo in the corner eating Doritos. You know, it's like the weirdest environment you could possibly think. And when you suppress reality in a situation like that, becomes like you're not like your every day, in which I did 1,000 movies in 6 years. Like, what that does to someone's mental and emotional health is destructive, because I'm literally suppressing reality, and a very uncommon situation becomes a commonality in my life, and that just becomes normative to me. And just because it's normative to me doesn't mean it's normal.
Yeah, well, it's like almost fight or flight, where your body or mind, everything was like, okay, in order to protect ourselves, we're going to make this normal.
Yeah.
And block out everything else just so you can
keep going
and keep managing your life. Do you think, like, from when they invited you down there and those three initial questions they asked you, obviously you're like, I want to be famous, which I think was, like, probably the most important question.
Yeah.
Do you think those people were like, hey, once he does this, he's ours because he's going to get rejected by everybody else and he's going to have nowhere else to go and we got him?
That's their MO.
Yeah.
Well, it's like if you can strip someone from if you can strip someone's human dignity,
yeah,
and you get them to adapt to being objectified and you get them to believe, well, I mean, literally, this is something that's said often on set, and you're like reintegrated into their mind. Who's going to marry you? You know?
Yeah.
Like, what are you going to put on your resume?
The deed's been done.
Yeah.
You're in.
It's like you got this scarlet letter that you're going to have to carry forever because what you just did is going to be on the internet for everyone to see forever. And not only is it this one time going to be on the internet, it's going to be partitioned into 10,000 different pieces of content. While I've done 1,000 films, it's partitioned into 100,000 pieces of different content because what you don't read on the contract is this little clause that says we can sell this to as many third parties and partition it as many times as we want, and it has no limit. So they sell the images to dating sites and sex toy shops and all this stuff, and it's like, you know, and because of the legalities of you're going by a pseudonym, like you're using a likeness, unless, because for the most part, like, no one is approaching it. It's like, okay, like, how, like, I need to, you know, I need to make sure that
I'm getting a percentage of every video sold,
like,
or clip.
Like anyone that's always asked me, it's like, oh, well, what did you, like, are you still getting royalties? Like, no one gets royalties in porn. Like, they're like, being robbed and being enslaved because they believe they can't do anything else. Like, the people who are making the money are the producers.
Yeah.
Because, like, the directors aren't far from where you're doing, you know? Because the directors, they'll get a nominal fee for creating a product that the producers will say, okay, you know, we're going to pay, sign you a contract, and you'll get, like, X amount of movies, X amount per movie. But that's essentially out the door now because, you know, this is, you know, I was in the industry, you know, back long enough where, like, DVD was still king.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah.
How much were they paying per?
Yeah, so, like, in the start, it was, like, $500 a scene. And then, like, towards the end of my career, it was, like, between, like, $1,500 and $2,000 a scene.
Okay.
Wow. So that first one that you did after you left disgusted, but was there some part of you also that was going, okay, well, it's done, it's over, I did it.
And I was like, I'll never do this again. I mean, I remember so clearly, it's like I had lube, like, in the hair of, like, on my thighs, and, like, they had hand soap in the shower in the studio, and I, like, tried to wash it out of me. It's like, man, I don't know if you've ever seen Redeeming Love. But it's this Christian movie, but essentially this girl who works at this brothel meets this Christian guy, and he convinces her to leave, and they get married. But she's so tied to the chaos in which she had lived her entire life. Like, her mom was a prostitute. She had been a prostitute since she was a young girl, and now as a woman, this guy had brought her out of that. And he was treating her well and giving her the life that she thought she would never have, but she didn't know what to do with the thing that she had now had. She thought she disqualified herself from this. There's no way that I'll ever be, you know, a wife or, you know, like, a homemaker or any of those things. And it was her uncomfortableness in her situation that led her back, and she went back to a brothel, and she did the thing that she hated doing because she found chaos, she found comfort in her chaos, and then she felt terrible for doing it. And there's this scene where she's in this river, and she's got rocks, and she's scrubbing her skin. And I saw that, I just started weeping, because literally, after every scene, I'm in a shower, and the filth I'm trying to wash off myself is not surface level.
Yeah. Yeah, it's embedded in your soul.
Yeah.
So you kept going, you obviously were like, all right, I'm going to keep doing this.
Yeah, I did that, and, like, my life blew up. And, like, even while I didn't enjoy it, it was like, well, I might as well make the best of what I got. And then at the same time, I was like, well, if I'm going to do it, just like who I am as a person, it's like, man, if we're eating chicken wings, it's like, I'm going to die before you beat me. You know, that's just who I am. So I thought, well, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to become the best in the industry. And I'm like, well, if I make X amount of dollars and I have X amount of success, that would equate for me feeling better about myself. So I was like tracking it. I was like, once I made $1 million, then I would feel good about myself. And I hit the metric and it didn't work.
Yeah.
And I won a bunch of awards while I was in that industry, but I got nominated for Performer of the Year, which means like the studios and the performers that have won it in past prior. They voted. They said, you know, you are the most influential, like best, like.
What are these stats to get Performer of the Year?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You know? Yeah.
What are the metrics they're going off?
Yeah,
of?
Yeah. Who knows? But it's like, but that award meant like, well, you could charge more, like,
yeah,
to like for you could increase your rate to be hired, and like you had this allure to you, you had more influence, you know, all this stuff. Like for me, it's like if you won that award, that meant, hey, you are good. You are worth something. You are the best. And I thought, well, if I won that award, I'd feel a certain way. And I got nominated 4 years in a row for it. And 3 years in a row, I didn't win it. But on the fourth year, I won it. And I thought, like, okay, I won that award. Like, this is going to make me feel amazing. And then I found out I won, and it didn't work. And when it didn't work, I very quickly made a plan to end my life because I'm like, hey, I have everything that I thought would fix me. Yeah, it's not working.
Mm-hmm.
I've got, you know, money in the bank and awards on my shelf, and people know not necessarily me, but they know this character in which I play. But I still, not only do I feel the same, I feel worse. And the anxiety that I already had was amplified, and the depression that already existed was deepened.
Did you, so during that time when you were making all these movies and, you know, getting nominated, when you walked around town or whatever, did people recognize, like, did people like, hey, man, I've seen you on so-and-so?
Yeah, and I think, living in Hollywood and, like, being in Vegas a lot, like, it was just a different type of vibe. So, like, people would come up to me at, like, restaurants, and I think part of it was like I would always date like an it girl or whatever, so I was always like dating someone that was popular in that industry also.
Yeah,
so they would like come up to us and say, you know, like, we know who you are, like, can we take a picture, you know, whatever. Which in retrospect, super weird. You know?
That's what I was gonna ask, like, when people did do that, how did you feel at the time if somebody was like, dude, I'm a big fan or whatever, like, what kind of feelings did you have at that time?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, you suppress reality to the extent where, like, you want them to be saying something they're not. Like, you don't want to hear, hey, I masturbate and watch your pornography. What you hear is, I'm a fan of your work.
Yeah.
And I'm good at something, and I'm creative enough at something that I'm good at my craft, and you are saying that I have value is what I convinced myself I heard. Yet what was true is there's a brokenness within me that I'm seeking intimacy on a screen and with my hand, and you happen to be the person in which I was objectifying that I extracted value from.
Yeah.
And I recognize you from that moment, which is what is true. But again, like, you would hear things and experience things through the lens of, I have to deny reality. Like I was sharing with you, like, you know, I was dating these girls, and more often than not, my friend group were people who were also in the industry. So we're sitting at dinner, and it's like, you know, this guy had sex with my girlfriend this week, and I'd had sex with his girlfriend this week. But yet we would say that we were both in a monogamous relationship and committed to one another. Yet we're suppressing reality, pretending that the work in which we do is not having sex with other people. It's adult film actors, and we're portraying something, yet what we're doing is real and has a real impact on our mental and emotional health. So by suppressing reality, it has a real impact on your mental health.
Oh, yeah.
That's wild. Can you imagine that? Like, sitting across and being like, okay, like, I sleep with your girl, you sleep with my girl.
But it's like, it's just work is what we convince.
And that's where, like, so I, yeah. And I get that concept of, you know, 'cause what you have to tell yourself is, this is just work. but now I'm dating this out when I'm off screen.
Yeah.
I'm dating this girl who also does the same job.
Yeah.
And that's where it's like, well, how does that work? I mean, being somebody that has no clue how, you know, how that works or whatever, but like having a relationship with somebody in that same industry and then after hours, like is even being intimate with them afterwards. I mean, does that?
Yeah. I mean, I would say it was weird. It's like, you know, like I worked so much, it was like, well, you know, I got to like save my supply, you know, it's like,
got to rest those hips.
Yeah. Yeah. That was reality. And it's like, I think like what separated me and like allowed me to have success to the extent that I did is that, I took it seriously. And like most people would show up and like, if they were, you know, they like in this time, they parodied a lot of movies, which is like, you know, cheesy and it's like funny to look back on somewhat. But like people would show up and like, I would know my lines. I would be where I was supposed to be, when I was supposed to be it,
mm-hmm.
Be there. I took care of myself. I was prepared. I treated, you know, the director and the producers with respect. I treated the girls with respect, you know, to the extent
yeah.
which I thought was respectful. And just like the normalities of just treating people, like took me really far in that industry because like it was like really broken people. And for the most part, my unique perspective in being in the industry was that I wasn't like at that point sexually abused. Like so many people were either trafficked or abused or they'd experienced something that justified what they were doing because of something that happened. Mm-hmm. So like in a weird way I was like somewhat of a normal guy.
Yeah.
I didn't have anything like glaringly traumatic happen in my childhood was like, I was an anomaly.
Well, to me, it sounds like, you know, cause I imagine, yeah, that group does a lot of broken people flock to that industry. Right.
Yeah.
But for you, even though you did come from somewhat of a broken home, like you talked about with your dad, but you were a professional, you were
yeah.
trying to be like, you went out there to be an actor or,
yeah,
you know, to be famous in some form or fashion, but then got suckered into
yeah.
the porn industry. But that did not take away from your drive to be a professional. And you were like, if I'm going to do this,
yeah.
then I'm going to do it to the best of my ability. And yeah, I mean, that's
it was fueled by your brokenness, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Like you're going, I got to prove my worth. I got
yeah.
to get to the top. I got to make performer of the year.
Yeah, and I think it all goes back to the garden where it's like, you know, that like. The serpent asked Adam and Eve, did God really say? And like we believe often that we can right our own ship. We can fix ourselves. We know what's best for us. And when we try to self-govern ourselves in a way in which we know what's best for us and we can fix the depths of brokenness within us, because often the way that we try to fix ourselves is we try to put enough good dirt on our bad dirt so we don't look dirty, and we're trying to manage the perception other people have of us in contrast to actually fixing anything within us.
Yeah, and that's also, I mean, that's Satan whispering his sweet little lies into you, like, oh, just do this, and
yeah.
you'll be fine,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's wild. It's wild to hear the perspective of what it's like also just you coming on set that first time you feel dirty, you leave there, and you go, man, it's probably like this mixed emotion where you're like,
yeah.
hey, they gave me all these compliments and said I was great, I'd be good in this, but I also
yeah.
feel disgusted. I need to wash, you know, you even talk
yeah.
about the lube in your... In,
yeah, but I mean, saying like if we're going to get like really real, you know,
yeah.
Just thinking like, at the end of my career, and then in most people, it's like, you know, for guys, you know, there's, you know, when I was in the industry, there's like 20, 25 guys who like are doing this like as a career. And it's because the director is, like, he's taking all the risk in that the director, he's paying for the talent, he's paying for the you know, whatever place they're filming in, you know, sound, video, like, all these things, editing, you know, permit, like, all this stuff. Like, so he's taking all the risk. And the guy is the only person on set that's not guaranteed to be paid. Because if the guy doesn't do what needs to be done, there's no product.
Yeah.
So the reason that only 20, 25 guys, it's like the director is like, hey, I trust this guy and I'm going to hire you over and over and over again. And because of that and the level of stress involved with that, That's why, like, people will use erectile dysfunction medication, and to the extent where a lot of people started using, it's called Caverjack. And so it's like you inject a chemical into the caverns of your penis, and it's erect no matter what you're doing, but it's for paraplegic people who want to be intimate with their spouse. So I just want to paint this picture. Like at the end of a lot of films where you think there's this like this beautiful moment happening and you're just taking a peek into the window of this like sexual act that's happening, there's two very broken people. Like this girl's using numbing cream. This guy has an erection based on a substance, and the girl, you think he's looking at the guy, but she's actually looking at the camera, and there's a camera like draped across your shoulder, and there's a boom mic by your head, and there's there's a sea light underneath your junk, and there's all this stuff happening, and then at the end you can't even climax from sex, and you're sitting there watching porn on your phone, masturbating, and you yell at the director when you're done, and they come and they film you climaxing, and then they edit it and they make it look as if there was this moment that they were just peeking in, they caught you having this crazy sex with this girl, and they actually captured this completely fictitious thing with these two very broken people, and in the product in which you're consuming is a complete fabrication of what actually happened.
Wow. You go and look at porn and jack off to looking at porn and then come back and come, like, with the girl just to shoot that. Yeah. That's wild.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that. I mean, I'm sure after doing that for so many times, it's like any other job you do
it becomes monotonous.
Yeah, like, this doesn't do anything for me anymore, but I'm still doing it to make money.
Yeah.
But, yeah, like, you're not going to be able to climax because you're like, this is my umpteenth time doing this.
And what's crazy is what we're seeing, like, it's insane. Like, 18 to 24-year-olds, like, the erectile dysfunction, like, on the incline. Like, 18 to 24-year-olds, like, struggling with ED, and it's because they've been watching porn for so long that they believe the lie that, well, if I get married, this will eradicate my porn addiction. So if I get married, I'll just have sex with my wife and I won't want to watch porn anymore. Not true. They bring the porn addiction into the marriage. And then they start saying, hey, the proclivities that I have, the fetishes that I have that I've actually developed through the perversion in which I'm watching this fictitious representation of sex, I'm now wanting to put on you. And maybe you don't meet the specs in which the porn I normally watch.
Yeah, what's
like
up here?
You don't meet the fantasy. But guess what? The fantasy's not real and no one's going to meet that. And they're trying to be intimate with their spouse and they can't because they're so addicted to a screen in their hand and a fantasy that when reality sets in, it's so different of a contrast that they don't even know how to process it. And it's like so there's shame and there's this like, well, I don't know how to be intimate because I've only experienced this imitation version of intimacy.
Through a screen.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wild. Was it wild, like, when, like, through that time, just, like, meeting, I can't imagine just meeting a girl and immediately having sex. Like,
yeah,
immediately.
But I would say, like, not even meeting. Like, so the girl's laying there looking at the camera, and then you walk in, and it's almost like you're just like a floating penis that comes into screen. You know, it's like because there's no, hey, how are you? Or is it okay if I do this? There's no consent. And here's the crazy thing. Like, when I say there's no consent, you give consent to what had happened prior it happening. So they're like, hey, what we're gonna do is film you giving consent to everything that's going to happen today as if it already happened, and we're just gonna do it because, like, you know, after you guys have sex and stuff, you'll be all sweaty and disheveled, and it'll be better for the girl this way. So we're actually gonna grab the consent on the front end before it happens so that you guys are not so disheveled. It's like we're just trying to help you out. But what actually happens is you don't think that your no has any validity, and anything the director tells you to do, you're gonna say yes to because you think that the only thing I can say is yes because my no doesn't matter. And if I say no, then it disqualifies me from the only thing I can say yes to. So literally anything the director says, you just do without thinking because you don't think that you're actually a human being. You're just an object in which you're being told to do. So it's more like puppet mastery than sex.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
That's crazy.
That's a twisted, dark industry.
Yeah.
So what, so after you got that award, right?
Yeah.
And then you said that didn't do anything for you. And then you went on the path of like, I think I'm going to end my life.
Yeah. So I Googled how many pain pills do I need to take to die. And I'd had knee surgery recently and happened to have them at home. So I'm like, great. I'm like, okay, I used to take this like, I forget, it's like animal stack or whatever. It was like 45 like vitamins, you know? So I knew like how I can swallow like X amount of pills at once. So I partitioned them into groups because I like, this is the maximum amount that I can swallow, but I don't want to try to swallow too many that I'll choke and I'll back out. So I'm like, I'm trying to make a plan so that I'm successful in what I'm going to do. And then while I'm making this plan, I just get this itch. And I've got this check in my pocket. I just got back from, so I flew from Atlanta to LAX. And I had filmed a scene in Atlanta. And I still had the check in my pocket. And I took it out and I looked at it on the memo of the check. It said, you know, like something sexual. Like, you know, in the memo of the check, like this is what the name of the movie was or whatever. And I thought, well, I still need someone else to tell me something about myself to justify what I want to do. So I wanted to walk into a bank and hand them the check and then look at it and be disgusted with me as I was disgusted with myself. And normally I would avoid that like the plague, you know, because I would do like ATM, mobile deposit, whatever, so that I wouldn't have to experience that. But this is exactly what I wanted on this day. So I walked in the bank, I slid the check across the counter, and just waited, and I was terrified, you know, like moments away from taking my life. And the transaction happens. She doesn't like do anything out of the ordinary. But then as I start to walk away, she says, "Excuse me, Joshua, can I help you? Like, are you okay?" And what she didn't know is that it had been over a year since I heard my real name, because in that industry you go by a pseudonym. And I had removed anyone that loved me enough to tell me the truth, which was, hey, the way that you're living is destructive and you're actually better than that.
So she called you by your first name.
She called me by my first name. It was the first time I heard it in over a year. Hmm. And that kind of like woke me up out of this numbness, this like reality that I created based on shame. And I went home and I called my mom, and my mom said everything that I didn't think that she would after she chewed me out.
Yeah.
because she had been calling and texting me for a year, and I hadn't responded. And, you know, there's people dying around me left and right, like people dying of AIDS, people committing suicide, people, you know, like falling out of windows and dying, and like all this stuff. You know, in a very real way, I was robbing my mom from just knowing if I was okay. And I'm like, I felt the guilt and the appropriate conviction of that. I'm like, I need to call my mom. So I like go home and I call her, and she, you know, she lays into me a little bit, and then she's like, hey, I just want you to know I love you, and you are so much better than this, and I just really wish you would just leave that and just come home. And on that day I did. So I called everybody I needed to call, and I was like, I quit, and I subleased my place and left. But what I brought with me was the mental and emotional trauma in which it happened to me. And then I started working at a strength conditioning facility. I had a great mentor. He was the strength conditioning coach for the Carolina Hurricanes. Poured into me, and then he started, so he leads the Thor program at Fort Bragg, and just like, just great guy, and just like pouring into me. The relational equity that he had, he opened up a lot of doors for me, like regarding being in that training space, and then ended up working at a gym, worked my way up, and was doing everything that I was before, like got all the credentials, had the right, you know, people vouching for me, started making good money, doing all this stuff, and all of a sudden I found myself in the same place, feeling the same way.
Yeah.
I removed myself from the specific toxic environment and doing the toxic things, but what I brought with me was the same habitual, you know, mindset. And 2 years into that, I meet this girl, and I'm like, hey, I just need to, you know, I've been sleeping around, I've been doing all this stuff, you know, I'm not that different, than the life that I've been living. Mm-hmm. And we meet to go on this run, and I was just like, man, I just need to tell her how big of a piece of trash I am, you know. I'm like, hey,
this is a girl that you're dating.
Yeah, and I'm okay. Just like, or this is like date one. You know, this okay, is like date, we're going right. for a run. And I'm like, hey, before anything starts, I just want you to know, you know, this is who I am. And I just give her like a 5-minute, you know, spill of like, this is how bad I am. And not only am I bad, I'm like this unvaluable person because my dad didn't even want me. So like, I'm unwanted and unvaluable, and I'm bad because my worst mistakes are easily found.
Hey, you talk about like a sabotage, but 5 minutes into a date, you're like, my dad, yeah. I'm a porn star, yeah. like yeah. all this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, this like, is, and I believed it. I was like, this is who I am, yeah. you know? And she was like, well, are you doing those things now? And I was like, no, yeah, I've been out of that industry for 2 years. At that point, so it had been 2 years, so out of the industry for 2 years. You know, not doing those things, but most certainly living that way.
Yeah.
She was like, okay. And she, you know, it felt like she was silent for a long time.
And then, it's a lot to process.
Yeah, yeah. And then she got really serious. And I thought, like, you know, is she going to slap me? Like, is she going to, like, tell me to get out of there? Is she going to, like, bounce? Like, what is she going to do? And she looks at me and says, I want you to know that you're not defined by the worst thing you've ever done. And you're not defined by the greatest thing you'll ever do. There's a God that exists outside of time, space, and matter, and he created everything, including me and you. And he has the final say. He determines who you are.
Come on.
Do you know him? I was like, maybe. You know? And if I'm honest, I grew up like going to church like as a kid, and I believed that God was real, so I probably would have attached myself to something that some people would say that they were Christian. You know, I might have even said that I was a Christian. But then she said, well, I've been following Jesus since I was 7 years old. I've been following Jesus since I was in the seventh grade. And I'm not perfect by any means, but my relationship with Jesus is the foundation from which I live my life. I'm not perfect, but he's the most important thing to my life. What kind of food do you like? What? She's like, what kind of goals do you have? Like, tell me about yourself. I was like, you don't want me to leave? She's like, no, I want to know, like, just know about you. Like, I just want to, like, know, like, different things about your life. And we just walked and talked for hours. And then I just, like, couldn't shake him. Like, she confronted the thing that I believed most true about me. Like, I thought I was, you know, this unwanted, bad person, yet she said that didn't define who I was. Like, what does that mean? And it just, like, it cultivated this curiosity in me. And then so a week after like us texting, like, you know, like high school maniacs, she invited me to church. And I walked into church and I saw this like giant wooden sign that said, we want to love people where they are and encourage them to grow in their relationship with Jesus Christ. And I was like, Jesus sounds cool, but if you knew who I was, no way.
Yep.
And then I heard this, you know, I'll try to make this short and stuff, regurgitating a whole sermon, but the pastor preached this message out of 2 Samuel chapter 9. It was about this dynamic between David, Ziba, and Mephibosheth, and at this point, David is kind of at the pinnacle of his reign, and Saul had been stripped from his kingship, and historically, anyone that was in an opposing family that was outside of the current family that was reigning, they were hunted down and killed because historically they would try to, you know, create an upheaval and overtake that kingdom because they thought they had access to the kingdom. So when Saul and Jonathan was killed, Mephibosheth, who was 5 years old, this nurse like picks him up and tries to run with him because she knew like dynastically your head's on a platter, you know?
Yeah.
And the Bible says, you know, he was dropped and he ended up lame in both feet. And like now in this story, David had this great relationship with Jonathan, who was the son of Saul. And he had actually said, hey, I'm going to let you know, like, when my crazy dad is trying to kill you, I got your back and I'll let you know. And they created this covenantal promise to one another. And David said, I'm going to show you the loving kindness of God, not only to like in this moment, but to you and your family forever. And David had just rebuilt the temple, and now he's contemplating, I've done something good for God. How can I do something good for God's people? And he remembers this promise, and he asks, hey, is there anyone left out of the family of Saul? And he summons a guard that used to serve underneath Saul, Ziba, and he says, hey, is there anyone left? And he's like, yeah, Mephibosheth is in this place called Lodabar. And he was in this, like, desert wasteland in this place in Palestine. And he's like, hey, go and get him and bring him to me. And Mephibosheth thought, like, okay, you know, it's D-Day, right? Yeah, I'm found. I'm in hiding in this place, Lodabar, meaning like place of no pasture, in this desolate place, because I'm hiding because I know that I deserve death. And he's before David, and David says, hey, I'm actually going to do different than what you think. I'm going to restore your grandfather's land, that land being part of Canaan, in that promised land. So you're now going to be invited into the family of God, because you're going to have a piece of the land of God, and I'm going to invite you into the kingdom, my kingdom, and you're going to have a seat at my table, not for a day, not for a week, but forever. And Mephibosheth's response is, don't you know who I am? I'm a dead dog. And when I'm hearing that, I was like, man, I resonate with that, because yeah. I'm hearing like, okay, Romans 3:23 says we've all sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And Romans 6:23 says the wages of sin is death. So like, yes, we're all guilty. Yes, we're all deserving of death. I understand we're all in the same playing field, but I've disqualified myself from the grace of God. I don't deserve that. Don't you know who I am? My daddy didn't even want me. And then he read Hebrews 12:2. He's talking about it was with joy set before him that Jesus endured the cross. So I understood that Jesus, yes, perfect in every way, being fully God and fully man, but he was not only obedient to his Father, and he had love in his heart for his Father, but he had love set in his heart for you and for me. So he went to the cross with joy set before him, because he loved you enough to do that on your behalf. And then, like, understanding, like, Romans 5:8, talking about it, when you know, Jesus, knowing the worst of us, he still goes to the cross.
Mm-hmm.
So in that moment, my presuppositions and who I thought I was based on what I've done, it was overrided by the love of God. And the love of God got a hold of me, and it wrecked me.
Wrecked you in a good way.
Yeah. And then that girl that we went on that walk, her name's Hope, and that's my wife. And we've been married for 8 years, and we've got 4 boys. And everything that I wrote on the day that I was going to take my life, I wrote on this piece of paper, reasons I want to die. I'll never be a father. I'll never be a husband. I'll never contribute to the world in a way that makes positive change. You know, Ephesians 3:20 is real. Like, God has done exceedingly more, you know, than I could ever hope, dream, or imagine. And it's been a wild ride.
I bet.
Yeah.
You know what I find remarkable, man, after hearing your story is the, just going, you know, the synopsis of what you just went through, the two main people that sort of woke you up were women.
Yeah.
After having a job that objectifies women.
Yeah.
I mean, objectifies men too, but I would say women more than men. I mean, yeah. Just yeah, from an outside perspective.
Certainly, yeah.
But yeah, I think that's, I mean, the girl at the bank calling you by your first name, sort of waking you up there, which then forced you to go home, called your mom.
Yeah.
Actually, 3 women.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then your mom tells you she loves you. Yeah. And then you get to meet your lovely wife, Hope, who brought you to the Lord. Yeah. I mean, that if that isn't God, then I don't know what is. Yeah. That's,
Your life is such an analogy. I mean, even in, when you were in the porn industry, you had a different name. Like, you were building this different identity.
Yeah. And like, then what I love, so the bank teller, so I love, like, how, like, God writes beautiful stories. You know, my story's not mine, it's his. Because I couldn't write a story this good. But thinking about, so a bank teller, like, she, you know, we've gotten somewhat away from, like, physical currency, but, you know, stick with me. So a bank teller gets very familiar with not fraudulent you know, bills. She doesn't become, you know, an expert in every fraudulent currency that exists. She gets very familiar with what is real, because when you know with what is real, you can identify what is not. And what she said was, my name Joshua, and Joshua means Yahweh is salvation. And the fact that she, like, you know, it makes me think, like, in Acts 16, there's this, you know, this beautiful recall of history where, like, Paul and some of the other disciples, they were crushing it. You know, they were casting out demons and baptizing people and doing all this stuff. And all of a sudden, there was this Roman upheaval, and they were stripped and beaten and thrown in prison. And then there was this earthquake. And when the earthquake happened, all the jail cells' doors opened up, and, you know, capital punishment was part of Roman culture. And this Roman guard saw the you know, all the doors opening up, and he's like, you know, I blew it, and I'm done. So he grabs the sword to take his own life, and Paul simply says, don't harm yourself, I'm right here. And the byproduct of that is him saying, hey, how do I come to know Jesus? How can I be saved? And he's saved. And then the byproduct of that is his whole family being saved. And it all started with the simplicity of Paul saying, don't harm yourself, I'm right here. And how many men that are in, like, someone listening to this lives that you need to check on them. You need to text them one more time. You need to call that person that has been dodging you. You need to have that lunch that you've been putting off because it doesn't line up with your schedule. Maybe it's the barista that you go to often, and you happen to remember their name, because there's things that the Holy Spirit prompts you to do to just say, hey, man, I see you.
Yeah.
In a place of, you know, in a world of nearly 8 billion people, so many people feel unseen. And when you feel unseen, you feel unimportant. And when you feel unimportant, you seem undeserving of love and life. And, man, I'm just so glad for the simplicity of what I believe the prompting of the Spirit was, that teller saying, hey, I see you in the middle of your brokenness, and I'm going to say the uncomfortable thing because I think it's important.
Yeah.
Was the teller, and then your mom, and what she said,
and
bringing you back, and then how cool is it? Your wife's name's Hope.
Yeah.
Like, the very thing you needed.
Yeah, and I'll just say, I mean, to the person that's, like, lived, a path of destruction, I think you disqualify yourself from hope because you feel like it's not attainable. And in my life, what I've found is, like, once you taste the thing that you thought you would never have, like, you will become the most dedicated, on fire individual ever, because all of a sudden, someone who thought they were dead men walking, all of a sudden you have an access to not only life here and now, but forever.
Which leads us into, you started a ministry, right?
Yeah, so 3 days, so I love that, like, so 3 days after I gave my life to Christ, I go to this church, and I'm like, hey, can I talk to a pastor? I got a story I want to share. And I was like, I feel like I need to be able to understand the Bible to tell it well, because it was God who saved me.
Yeah.
And this guy, his name's Andrew, he had just finished up at Dallas Theological Seminary, and he was serving as a pastor at this church in Raleigh. And he was like, hey, you know, I can meet with you, like, sure. And he planned, you know, I still am friends with him today. And he was like, man, I've heard you share the story that I had all this time in the world because I was a new guy. Being in ministry for a while, it's like the new guy's got the most stuff to do.
Oh, yeah.
But he was like, I didn't have time to sit with you like I did. But I thought, like, okay, I'm going to give you a Bible and say, you know, here's observation, interpretation, application. Like, here's how you read the Bible in proper context. Like, here's, like, a quick little lesson. Read the book of John. Get plugged into a small group. Instead, he felt prompted by the Spirit. He's like, man, I need to spend some time with this guy. And we spent about 10 to 15 hours a week for several years together. And he taught me how to read the Bible. He taught me how to study the Bible. But what most importantly, he taught me how to be a son. Because, like, to become a man of God, to become a godly husband, a godly, you know, father, like, all these things, understanding who I was in Christ, like, through sonship, I understood who my truest identity was.
Yeah.
And that came from him calling me out and calling me up. And like Proverbs 27:6 talk about the wounds of a friend. Like sometimes we need people to say the stuff that stings a little bit because they love us enough to say it.
Mm-hmm.
But we would have these conversations every Friday. We called them HOT conversations. So acronym. So honest, open, and transparent. And he would not just ask me like, hey, are you doing the right things? What does it look like when you're thinking the wrong thing? Where does that emotion take you? Like, even if you didn't do what you set out to not do, like, what other behavior? You know, it's like, because for me, I was, like, struggling with lust, and that lust, lust wasn't born out of that, or, like, any kind of sexual immorality wasn't born out of it, but, like, I would operate in anger. You know, I'd be, like, so frustrated that I was still dealing with this crap that I was, like, you know, I need to man up more. You know, I need to white knuckle it more. So, like, how can I have this legalistic approach to, like, how can I eradicate this behavior in my life? And what's true is, like, you think about the scripture talking about if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off. It's a metaphor in that you are not capable of cutting yourself off from the thing that you're desiring, because if we have this humanistic approach to it, it's like, well, if I've got a problem with masturbation, then if I cut my hands off, I wouldn't be able to do it. But the problem would be I would still have a mind.
Yeah, you still have those thoughts.
It, or I would have eyes to see it. And the problem lies in your heart. And you need spiritual heart surgery, and only Jesus can do that. So how do I fix it? It's like, man, Titus 2 talks about, you know, the byproduct of saying no to ungodliness is you start to develop an appetite for righteousness. If you got two hungry dogs in the fight, whichever one you feed is going to be the strongest, and that's direction that he's going to pull, you know, the quote-unquote sled, which is you. So he sat me down, and he encouraged me, but he gave me a lot of kicks in the butt also, and I think I needed that, because until you have self-awareness, you can't be obedient or disciplined. So I needed to see myself from an outside point of view, and people needed to say things to me with all the information, right? Not just what I wanted him to hear, but I trusted him enough to tell him what was actually going on.
Yeah.
And through taking inventory of my life, we could reassess and create some boundaries and, you know, set some things in place. But, you know, you're only as free as you're willing to be honest. And if you're not willing to be honest, there's going to be this portion of you that's still, you know, chained to the wall of brokenness. Even if the shackles are open because of Christ, you're chained to the wall mentally, and you're going to continue to walk with this spiritual limp. Because you feel like, well, this is the way it's always going to be, because I'm not willing to say the thing I don't want to say.
Yeah, and that's what we were talking about earlier before the interview, like giving yourself to Christ. You can't give 99.9%. It's got to be 100%, because that small little portion that you're deciding to keep for yourself will become heavier than you can handle eventually.
I just want to like nerd out with you guys real quick. I'll be quick, but so like there's this portion in John 21 where Jesus restores Peter, and you know Peter was, you know, he was the OG rock, you know, he was the rock before the rock was a rock, you know, but then three verses later he was Satan, you know, Jesus called him Satan, and he said, I would never do this, you know, I would never do this thing, I would never deny you, yet he did it three times. And then John 21, we see like Jesus he's been resurrected, and he maybe even he had seen them, but they hadn't had like an interaction. And then John 21, like Jesus is cooking breakfast on the shore, Peter sees him and he goes to him, and they have this conversation. Jesus says like, do you love me? Yes. Do you love me? Yes. Do you love me? Yes. But like, what's really beautiful about that is that there's this Greek word anthrakeia, and it means like these burning coals, and it's only found twice in the New Testament. It's found the first time in John 18 when Peter denies Jesus for the first time, and the second time is when Jesus says, hey, do you love me? And our sense of smell is so connected to our sense of memory, and sometimes we need to go back to the place in which we failed so that we could be restored and find healing, because until you're willing to go back to that place, you're not going to be able to get to the place you want to get to. And the language in that, in the Greek, it says, you know, we've got, you know, love means I love donuts, I love weightlifting, I love my wife. You know, it sounds the same, means very different. In Greek, there's different words that are more precise for what it means. And Jesus says, do you agape me? Do you commit to the totality of love in which I love my people? It's sacrificial. Like, do you love me like that? Peter says, I phileo you, which is like a brotherly love. And then Jesus says, would you agape me? He's like, I phileo you. And then Jesus is like, well, do you phileo me? He's like, yeah, I can commit to that. And the lesson that's in that is like, hey, if you commit and you bring to Jesus who you truly are, like not the person you wish you would be, not the person you portray yourself to be, like who you really are, like all your crap, all your dirt, all your sin, all your brokenness, like all of it, if you bring that person to the place of Jesus, to the foot of the cross, if you bring that person to him, that's where you're going to find healing.
Mm-hmm.
Because what does Jesus say? Okay, go feed my lambs. You're not a fisherman. I've told you that since we met. Go do what I called you to do and be the person that I've called you to be, because you've disqualified yourself because of something you've done and you don't get to identify yourself. So if you want to you want to feel fulfilled, you want to feel restored, go do the thing I called you to do. Because if you truly love me, you'll trust what I say.
Yeah, you'll submit.
And then that's how we get to Acts 3, where, you know, with zeal, he's preaching to a Jewish audience, him being a Jew, saying, you denied the Christ, you crucified him, and so did I. My sins put him on that cross as well. So I'm telling, please, repent, turn from what you're doing, because I know what it cost me. But yeah.
That's an incredible story, man. I mean, and to go from that to what you're doing now, and then, I mean, I imagine you're going around giving talks and...
Yeah, so, and, yeah, travel all over the place, giving talks. I love partnering with organizations that are doing good work, and I'm lobbying for legislation to happen. I'm speaking into sex trafficking and human trafficking organizations and preaching the gospel. And it's like God has me in all these places, and I find myself often saying, "Hey, what the heck am I doing here?" And it's like, "Well, it doesn't really matter."
Nope, he's using you for exactly what you need to be used for. You've lived in, you walked through, like we talked about earlier, the shadow of darkness. You made it through that, and that is, it's on you to start helping others, because you've seen the darkness. And we talked about that, you know, earlier too, about keeping some of that experience that you had through there, because that is what's going to help you relate to others that are going through the same struggles, and not completely dispelling everything.
Yeah.
Like, and, you know, cleansing yourself, I guess, and being like, okay, I'm no longer that person. No, it's good to have some of those traits. So you can, like I said, you can relate to people when you're talking to them and actually pull them through whatever darkness they're going through.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, like vulnerability is always going to be the quickest bridge to connectivity. And it's like, hey, when I can say, hey, I can relate to what you're talking about because I've been where you are or where you've been. And I want to tell you, man, actually healing is possible. Like having a healthy marriage is possible. Being a good father is possible. Even if you didn't see it modeled, even if you experienced it in a negative way, that doesn't have to become who you are or what you do, because there is something greater that defines you, and there is healing and restoration, all these things that can and will take place because of what Jesus has done on the cross. But like to your point, it's like, man, the reason I'm successful at what I do today is because I didn't throw away everything I've learned from the things that I've done, even if they didn't glorify God, because God was with me in that. And some of the characteristics and personality traits and gifts and talents that I was using in an inappropriate way, God redeemed and restored those. And those things in your personality surrendered and submitted to the person of Jesus are now the most advantageous things to you, because you're now using the things in which he gave you for his glory, for his purposes, for his plan. And if you say, hey, I can't do that because I did not want to communicate. I did not want to have any kind of platform. I didn't want any of that. He's like, well, you know, it's a sin of omission for me to be disobedient to what he's calling me to, because it's never been about me, you know?
Yeah, that reminds me of...
Similar to you.
Yeah, well, my favorite quote, and I'll say it again. Through faith, this pain will serve you well. And you have to take, while you're going through that, you take that pain and you go forward with it and help others.
Amen.
Dude, it was awesome. Awesome having you on. Love your story.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Love your story.
And we got the book. What's it called?
Yeah, Seven Lies That'll Ruin Your Life.
Seven Lies That'll Ruin Your Life.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll definitely check it out for sure.
Cool, man. Thank you so much.
Yeah.